Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the abuse excuse when we come back. You know, back in 1970, the world food supply was about 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to less than 38 days. Now, we Americans produce grain for export, all right, but then our grapes are imported from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. You know, our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 population reduction program. Now, this globalization may be good for business, but globalization is bad for you, and it's bad for me. Back in 1940, we all had a pantry full of food to feed our families for a year or more. Today, we Americans have a 3-day supply of food in our refrigerators, and we believe in our supermarket system of just-in-time delivery to feed us all forever. But over the past 60 years, we've now traded a 1-year food supply for 3 days. Now, these global 2000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, plague, disease, and pestilence to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years, or so says the Club of Rome. Now, these evil madmen with their global 2000 genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for. And I say, let them die for their cause. But let's you and I live for our cause. Now let me show you from the scripture how to be a live survivor instead of a dead victim. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine, send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're talking about The Abuse Excuse. It's a book written by Alan Dershowitz. Remember Alan Dershowitz, the flaming liberal law professor from Harvard University. But in his book called The Abuse Excuse, he lays out a number of abuses that need to be corrected. And so I selected out a number of them here. I'm on censorship right now that I thought needs to be reported on. Somebody needs to come along and say, hey, wait a minute, this is an abuse and it needs to be changed. And then you need to be aware of it. You can't change something you don't know anything about. But you remember O.J. Simpson? O.J. Simpson, back in the 1990s, allegedly killed his wife. And that case sensationalized the abusive husbands and their abuse toward women. And then, of course, the women's groups, you know, they pick right up on that and they say, now, see, all these men out here are just looking for a woman to beat up on or to kill, you know, in extreme circumstances. Now, Dershowitz takes exception to that and said, now, listen, did you know this? So listen up. Though O.J. Simpson vehemently denies that he murdered his former wife, His case has provoked a flurry of media attention toward other husbands who kill their wives. And coincidentally with the Simpson case, the Department of Justice has just released the first detailed empirical study of murder in families. And that study contains some very surprising information. And that information contrasts sharply with the media headlines. I'm going to underline that. Media headlines. And I reported on that to you last time. I said, now listen. You know, we see something and it needs to be fixed. And then we got to write a story, got to write an article, and we write the story or the article, and then we lie. Two ways to deceive here. We either lie to you directly and tell you something that isn't true, which is very common now, or we don't tell you the rest of the story. We give you certain inflammatory information, but then we don't modulate that information by telling you the rest of the story, which then gives you a distorted view of the subject matter. Listen to this. The most shocking finding of this study, which analyzed nearly 10,000 cases, is that wives murder their husbands far more frequently than press reports would suggest. Now, to put the issue into context, women in general account for only about 10% of defendants who are charged with all murders. Okay, so let's tuck that one away in our heart. If you take a look at the murder rate in America, 90% are committed by males and 10% are committed by females. All right, 90-10. But for all spousal murders, that is, women killing their husbands or husbands killing their wives, women accounted for more than 40% of the defendants. Ah, now all of a sudden, wait a second here. It's not 50-50. It's more like 60-40 or 55-45. It isn't quite 50-50. That's true. But now when we take a look at family killings, that is, when somebody kills not just a husband or a wife, but what happens in a family when one of the family members kills the children or kills a mother or father, then we find out that women kill more family members than men do. How do you like that, ladies? Now, the purpose behind this media blitz is an agenda. And the agenda is to brand all men as wicked, evil, heinous wife beaters and wife killers. Men who kill their wives need to be taken care of, no doubt about it. But did anybody ever tell you that women kill their husbands nearly as often as men kill their wives? Did anybody tell you that women kill more of their children, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, and husbands than do men? Women kill more than men do. Did anybody tell you that? Now that's called censorship. It isn't that the information isn't known. It's that when some woman is writing an article and she's trying to promote the concept that men abuse their wives. Has it ever occurred to you that maybe wives abuse their husbands? How often does that occur? Now, among black marital partners, wives were just about as likely to kill their husbands as husbands were to kill their wives. It's about 50-50. Not surprisingly, when it comes to parents who kill their children, mothers kill more often than fathers. And the real headline of this report, therefore, is that women kill almost as often as men do in the context of all family murders, though men much more often kill strangers, nearly always other men. So when a man kills somebody, it's probably going to be a stranger, and it'll be another man. That's more likely. But when a woman kills, it's more likely to be her children or her husband than it is to be a stranger. Here's another little factoid over here that comes into play. Do you notice this? That the real headlines of this report, therefore, is that women kill almost as often as men do in the context of all family murders, though men much more often kill strangers. So when we're talking about families over here, you're more likely to be killed by a female, by a wife, than you are to be killed by a stranger. Now, did you know that, boys and girls? So when Dershowitz comes forward, he says, wait a minute, now we're suffering from censorship, and the censorship is by women and women's groups who don't want you to know the other side of the story. And that's what censorship is all about. We're not telling you the full story. Not to justify men beating up on their wives or killing them. But hey, listen, girls, let's pay attention here to reality. That is not a phenomenon that's associated with men only. Now, the other shocker in this report is that husbands who kill their wives are not treated more leniently than men who kill strangers, despite all of the media hype and media myths to the contrary. Indeed, men were as likely to be charged with first-degree murder, were no more likely to have their cases dismissed or diverted, and were as likely to be convicted, nor were their sentences significantly different when relevant case characteristics, such as prior criminal record, were taken into account. And indeed, the only real difference is that spousal murders required less time to disposition than other types of murder cases. So when we have a husband killing his wife or a wife killing her husband, it does not take nearly as long to get that case to trial and get a conviction as it does when you have an ordinary murder. I say ordinary murder. Despite this hard data, the myths persist that spousal murders consist almost exclusively of husbands who kill their wives and are then treated leniently by the criminal justice system. Indeed, there is one figure that is strikingly missing from this otherwise thorough report, and namely, whether women who murder their husbands are treated more leniently than husbands who murder their wives. So I phoned the author of the report and I asked him if that data was available, and he told me that it was, but that he had not compiled it. So I asked him if he would compile that data, and he did. And he faxed me the new tables that compared the outcome of prosecution based on the gender of the victim and the gender of the accused. Now, this previously unpublished data dramatically undercuts the myth that husbands who kill their wives are treated more leniently than wives who kill their husbands. The available evidence points overwhelmingly in the opposite direction. All right, so let's pause and think about that for a minute. If you're a man and you killed your wife, are you going to be treated more leniently than if your wife kills you? And the answer is no. So let me tell you a little story here. There was a case out in Idaho, I think over in Caldwell, Idaho, that Ben Rice defended. He defended the woman in this case. And here's the essentials. This guy was beating up on his wife, and this wife is suffering from what they call battered woman's syndrome. Battered woman's syndrome. There's actually a medical discussion or discourse on this subject. That's where women are beaten up by their husbands and they don't leave. They stay right there and they keep beating them and beating them and beating them. Now, you think, you know, if this woman was getting beat up, you know, regularly by her husband, when he goes to work and he's nowhere around, she'd get in the car, drive away, and never come back. Or that she would call the police when he's gone and get a restraining order. That she would, you know, do something to solve the problem. But women don't do that. Or at least a significant number of women don't. I don't know how many do or don't, but there's a bunch of them that don't. And so they came up and they said, gee, there's some kind of a psychological hang-up here. This woman's got a problem. And she's getting beat up over here. She's suffering from battered woman's syndrome. And so there was no doubt about this. Hell, the neighbors knew it and so on. Well, anyway, and this guy, he threatened to kill her several times. And it was well established at trial that this guy had threatened to kill this woman. Now, you know, in the heat of an argument or in the heat of passion, you know, sometimes people say things that they ought not to have said, like, I'm going to kill you. Well, you know, in reality, when somebody says something dumb like that, they actually don't carry it out, but sometimes they do, but, you know, most times they don't do that. Well, this guy had threatened to kill this woman on more than one occasion, and there was more than one witness to it. So it wasn't just her word, you know, that just said this. But anyway, time progresses along here, and one day this woman walks up behind her husband with a 12-gauge shotgun while he's eating breakfast at the kitchen table and pulls the trigger and blows this guy's head off. Now, she kills her husband at the kitchen table. She calls the police and says, I had to kill him. It was self-defense. Now, it's hard to argue self-defense when you shoot somebody in the back, you know. It's easier to argue self-defense if you shoot him in the chest. He just wouldn't stop. He just kept coming. I told him, stop, stop, and he wouldn't do it. So I had to kill him because I was afraid he was going to kill me. But she shot him in the back of the head at the kitchen table while he was eating breakfast. And so the case goes to trial. Ben comes in, and he applies the battered woman syndrome defense. And he paints the picture of this guy beating this woman, and he was really a bad guy. And so what he really did was he put the husband on trial. Now, the husband isn't there to deny any of the allegations that are being made against him in the trial. See, the trial, we're trying this woman for killing her husband. But the defense lawyer, now he's crafty. You know, he's sitting there saying, well, I can't deny that my client here shot and killed her husband. But I need to picture this husband over here as needing killing. I've got to picture him as a killer himself. And so they introduced evidence, and the wife got on the stand, and she said, he said he was going to kill me right after breakfast. He said that after breakfast, when he got through eating, he was going to kill me. Well, he had threatened to kill her before, and he hadn't done it. So what would make her think that today was the big day? So, moral to the story here is that the jury, when they were polled, they came back, found her not guilty, and they polled the jury, and the jury came to this conclusion. They said he needed killing. He needed killing. And that may have been true. I mean, this guy may have been one of the worst, dirty, no-good SOBs that God ever put breath into. But now, if we just walk up behind our husbands, ladies, and shoot them in the back of the head because we have a disagreement or we don't like them, or vice versa, you know, the violence continues on, the killing continues, and we got a law here that says, you shall do no murder, thou shalt not kill. You ever heard that? I mean, God Almighty himself said he didn't want people running around deciding who they're going to kill and who they aren't. It's against the law to do that. And so that doesn't prevent a lot of killing, but it goes to show you that there's a law that tells us not to do that, and that there are consequences that come from it. But now the women's groups out here have this thing totally turned around, that the husbands are always the dirty, low down, no goods that are killing their wives and beating their wives. And more likely than not, it is the husband beating his wife rather than the wife beating up on her husband. That's certainly true. And the women are encouraged to leave abusive circumstances. You know, when your husband goes to work, you know, lady, get the hell out of there. File an action against this guy, you know. And, you know, women will come up with 55 reasons as to why they didn't do that, but wouldn't that be a better solution than killing this guy? I mean, it would help you a great deal, and it would save you a lot of anguish, because you didn't know how that jury was going to come back, guilty or not guilty, see? Now, despite all of this hard data, the myths persist that spousal murders consist almost exclusively of husbands. But now we find that's not true. Wives who kill their husbands are acquitted in 12.9% of the cases studied, while husbands who kill their wives were acquitted only 1.4% of the cases. So this woman here was acquitted. Now, it is true. Normally, ladies, when you go up and shoot your husband at the breakfast table in the back of the head, the statistics are 87% of the time you're going to be convicted and 13% of the time you're going to be acquitted. But if your husband walks up behind you and blows your head off, he's only going to win about 1% of the time. 99% chance he's going to be convicted. But there's a 13% chance that you'll be acquitted, ladies. So if you want to know who's going to get treated more leniently in a spousal murder case, it's the woman is always 13 times more likely to be acquitted than a man. So again, this censorship, you know, this agenda that women's groups have to paint all men as sadistic, wife-beaten killers over here, just taint so. Taint true. Now, women who were convicted of killing their husbands were sentenced to an average of 6 years in prison, while men received an average 17 years for killing their wives. And 16% of female spousal killers get probation compared to 1% for males. So by almost every other measure as well, female spousal killers are treated far more leniently than male spousal killers. To be sure, some of the differences may be attributable to gender-neutral factors, such as prior record, provocation, or mental illness. But there's absolutely no support in this data for the claim that husbands who kill their wives are systematically treated with kid gloves by the justice system. That's a fiction. That isn't true. But that's what's being painted out there, and that's censorship again. It's censorship. Nobody's telling you this side of the story. And it isn't because that the information isn't available. The information's out there. I just reported it to you. Now, I'm just a crummy plumber, and if I've got the information, surely the women's groups, you know, Now and Women's Libs and so on, they've got the information too. So do the newspaper reporters who are painting these stories in the newspapers and magazines like Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report and Reader's Digest and so on. They all know that, but they're not reporting that to you. Now, I'm not here trying to justify men's abuse against women, but I want all of the facts so that I can make an intelligent and an informed decision and to form an opinion as to how we're going to deal with this or what we ought to do to deal with it. And I don't need the newspaper or the magazine or the reporter over here to withhold information from me to help me form my opinion. I resent that. I don't want that. And Dershowitz doesn't like it either. And that's why he reported in his book. It's called The Abuse Excuse. And so women claim, well, I'm being abused. Okay, but that's an excuse to justify murder. And the idea that men are always the perpetrators and women are always the victims is poppycock. Pure and simple. Poppycock. Or that men are treated more leniently than women in a spousal murder case. And that's poppycock. Taint so. In fact, the statistics are so overwhelmingly out of balance in the opposite direction that it's a miracle. It's a wonder that these lying newspaper reporters and TV and magazine writers are able to get away with it. But they've done it. And that's why we call this the mass media. the mass media. We believe what Brian Williams tells us. Brian Williams goes to a computer data bank and he gets the information. I reported this to you last time on, say, Michael Milken or People Magazine in this case. Michael Milken was accused of insider trading. Now, for the average Joe Sixpack, that's you and me, what the hell difference do we care about is the guy charged with or convicted for insider trading or for some technical violation? But to Mr. Milken, it makes a big difference. It makes a big difference. It doesn't to me and it doesn't to you, but it does to this guy because now it turns him into a victim. Now, it is true he did plead guilty to breaking some laws, but he didn't plead guilty to insider trading. And that isn't what he was convicted for. And in fact, he was exonerated by the court in that charge. See, they said, no, you didn't do that. He did do something that was wrong, but that isn't what he did. What they reported on, he didn't do. You know, right's right and wrong's wrong. You know, and let's understand it and then let's identify it. So don't believe everything that you hear. I reported that to you last time. I said, hey, you know, a lady called up on the radio, the show that I was on, and made a report. Her report was false. The report that she made was true concerning the context of a business raid on a business that allegedly didn't have a license. But her construction of it was is that the government's coming in here and confiscating your and my private food storage. That's not true. Government's not doing that. Not yet. They may. Have they ever in the past? Oh, yeah. During the Civil War, it was common for military forces to just come in, take people's stuff. They just come out there on the farm, take all your cows, kill them, and feed the troops. You know, that's understandable. That goes on all the time in war. And I'm not here to tell you that may not happen again. But that isn't the state of affairs going on December the 1st, 2008, in the state of Ohio. That's just not true. It's not going on that way. And now, people believe lies because those lies are being perpetrated against them by the mass media. The mass media is filled with liars. And I'm sure that the reporters are probably sitting there saying, well, I don't intend to lie. I don't know. Let me back up over here. Remember, I read to you this article. It's actually an ad. I put this on every now and again. Let me read it to you again. This guy's name is John Swinton. Let's think about this guy, John Swinton, because he made this statement back in 1880. And Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft. John Swinton is a newspaper editor. I mean, he's not just a crummy reporter. Hell, he's the editor of the paper. And he's being honored. You know, it's kind of like Katie Couric being honored at a banquet where she's just won the Pulitzer Prize for a story that she's done or something on that order. See? And Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given him by the leaders of his craft. Someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Oh, Katie, let's drink a toast to the independent press at CBS News. And Swinton outraged all of his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. Now, you know it, and I know it. He's not talking here. He's not writing an editorial. He's not writing a piece in a paper making a statement on a call-in talk show. He is talking directly to his peers. He's talking to other newspaper reporters. You know, in 1880, most of them are newspaper reporters. There's no radio or TV present. Today, we have radio, TV, magazines, newspapers. Do these people tell us the truth? Hell, they lie to us constantly. These people are so wrapped up in their own damn lies, they believe their own press releases, for crying out loud. My point is, I wanted to report to you that what's going on out here in the reporting field forms our opinions. This is why we vote for the candidates we vote for. It's based upon our perceptions. It's based upon the information that we receive from Brian Williams and Katie Couric and the newspapers and magazines and so on. These reports, we know we watch Washington Week in Review or the McLaughlin Group, and we listen to these guys as they're talking, and Gwen Ifill and so on, and Lair NewsHour. And we believe what they report. We believe what we see reported in our papers and we see on television. Swinton comes back and says, there's no such thing. This is 1880. This is no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. Now, you know it and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions. And if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. He went on to say the business of a journalist is to destroy the truth. The business of Brian Williams and Katie Couric is to destroy the truth. That's what they're hired for. That's their business. That's what they get paid for. Let me read that to you again. He said, the business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to just plain look you right in the eyeball and lie to you. That's his job. That's what he's getting paid for. I reported last time about the SWAT team that come in to this guy's house. This guy's Amish. He's a pacifist. They come in with guns drawn, and they set these people down on the couch, and for 8 or 9 hours, they just terrorize these people. Oh my God, why would they do that? It's their job! A SWAT team is there for the purpose of terrorizing people. It's what they're hired for. It's what you're paying for. It's what you get. Now, what do you get when you hire a newspaper reporter? You get a paid professional liar. It's his job. If he tells you the truth once in a while, that's a part and parcel of his overall job description. He's a lying deceiver. And in order to deceive you, he has to tell you the truth from time to time. If he always lied to you, you would always know the truth. If he always told you the truth, you'd always know the truth. To deceive you, he has to tell you the truth and mix it with lies. When Satan, in the Garden of Eden, said to Eve, you will not surely die. He didn't lie to her. Hell, he told her the truth. You see, Eve said to Satan, she said, God said that in the day that we eat thereof, we will surely die. Satan said, no, that's a lie. That's not true. Eve ate off the tree, and you know something? She didn't die. Think about that. Hell, Satan told her the truth. But he withheld certain information from her. And the information was that that statement can be taken two ways. In the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die. Meaning that in the day that you eat thereof, it ultimately is going to lead to your death 930 years from now. That's what happened, and that was the truth. In the day that you eat thereof, in the context of today, Wednesday, July 9th, year zero, when you eat off that tree, you will not surely die. She ate off the tree on Wednesday, July 9th, year zero, and by God, she didn't die. Did she? She went on to have children. She went on to live her life. But she ultimately died. So there was a statement that could be taken two ways. And do you know that in the final analysis, when it was all said and done, that woman died? God told her the truth, but so did Satan. But Satan was a little different in his statement. He withheld certain information. He was a censor. Satan is the author of censorship. Think about that. Hey, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors and publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. Let's all keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile. They could be political, religious, economic. Sometimes they're sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear in this program are mine, or mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this local radio station, or of this network. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a book called The Abuse Excuse, written by Alan Dershowitz. It probably has, I'm just going to make a guess here, 3 pages, probably got about 100 of these stories in it, 100 abuses, in which he says that the basic problem in American society is that Americans do not want to take responsibility for their actions. And so they're coming up with all these excuses. He calls it the abuse excuse. And boy, he hit the nail on the head many times. Now, sometimes, and here I take exception with him, but he's done a hell of a job, and I think it's a dynamite book. That's why I'm reviewing it. It's the only one I've ever seen like it. It kind of reminds me of Bill Cosby taking to task the black community in America for their lack of education. And Bill Cosby, who's a black entertainer here in the United States, oftentimes takes to task this. Listen, you know, the average black kid can't even speak English. How in the hell is he going to get a job? He can't even speak the language. Now, I always thought that blacks could not speak English because they had some kind of a physical impediment, you know, maybe their tongue, palate, you know, speech. People have different languages around the world. You take Chinese, you know, they can't say R. And that's not necessarily true. In their language, they probably don't have a sound for R. And black people can speak perfect English. You know, that was a misperception on my part. What's happening here in America is what Bill Cosby has pointed out, and he hit the nail right on the head. He said these kids are deliberately being educated, or in this case, miseducated, so that they can't speak, so that they can't get work, so that they can't get a job, so that they can't function in the real society, which leaves them then out on the streets peddling drugs. Well, I couldn't agree with Bill more. Now this guy, Alan Dershowitz over here, hits the nail right on the head again with the abuse excuse by saying plainly, he says, you know, people need to take responsibility. That is, you need to take responsibility for your actions, and I need to do the same, and so does everybody else. You know, we're all adults, and we're the ones that are doing this to ourselves. But it's difficult. It's difficult because we're being lied to constantly. And we get misinformation, which gives us a bad perception, gives us a misperception of what's really going on. So in my report here today, wives also kill husbands quite often. In fact, it's nearly as often as men kill their wives. Wives are killing their husbands. And among blacks, it's about 50-50. And if you take a look at the number of women who are killing family members, they kill more family members. They'll kill their children quicker than a man will. Now, I'm not here to justify this and say, well, that's good. But my point is that the news media has this thing turned around, and they have an agenda. They're trying to destroy the American family. They've already done it. They've succeeded in their goal by pitting men against women. And this is where we have this male-female, this man against woman, this wife against husband controversy, which is kicked up in our comedy, in our television, in our newspapers and magazines, and in our reporting. So I reported to you that John Swinton back in 1880 said, listen, the purpose, the very reason for being of a newspaper reporter, a television reporter, is to lie outright, to destroy the truth, to pervert it, to vilify, to make men look like they're animals, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. God, what an indictment. That's an insider. You know, as a plumber, I come here and I say, you know, the press is biased. See, that's not nearly as good as having Katie Couric come in and say, let me tell you what goes on at CBS Evening News. Once in a while, one of the insiders comes forward and says, hey, let me tell you what's really going on back here. And God, what a revelation that is. And Alan Dershowitz, who's an attorney, a lawyer, college professor, comes around and says, hey, listen, you know, I'm rubbing elbows with people that are making these abuse excuses. I'm the guy that's teaching the lawyers who are going out into society and raising these abuse excuses to get people that should be put in prison or should be executed. Now, this guy's opposed to the death penalty. Alan Dershowitz, opposed to the death penalty. And I would disagree with him on that point. Because God himself instituted the death penalty for about 24 classes of crimes. And evidently Mr. Dershowitz over here takes exception with God and says, well, God, you made a mistake. I take the other view. I don't think that God made a mistake. I think Dershowitz is in error here. But nevertheless, you know, we can agree to disagree civilly. I mean, I don't think that his position's correct on the death penalty or on abortion or on pornography. And that's because I take a look at what God in the Scripture tells us about the death penalty, about abortion, about pornography, and I say, that sounds like to me that God's got a little better program there. But nevertheless, Dershowitz has hit the nail on the head over here in exposing these outright manifest lies, these agendas that the news media and certain groups with an agenda are promulgating upon you and me and everybody else, which distorts our view of the real world. And that's called censorship. And censorship isn't just somebody putting a black line through a line so that you can't read it. Censorship comes in a number of ways. And in his section here on censorship, he points that out. And I think he did a hell of a job. All right. Now, censoring lawyers. On page 299, he came up with a little story over here on censoring attorneys. And he said, Shakespeare's revolutionary character, Dick the Butcher, announces in Henry VI, Part 2, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. Well, in real life, revolutionary tyrants, from Robespierre to Stalin to Mao, did in fact go after the lawyers first. And attorneys are, after all, easy targets. The current joke asks, what's a load of lawyers sinking at sea? The answer, a good beginning. Lawyers are important targets for tyrants because lawyers help citizens and ordinary people to secure their rights against government tyranny. Pause right here. Now, I've got a lot against lawyers. But, you know, that's a true statement. Take those people down in Guantanamo. They don't speak English. They're locked up. They've been locked up by our government. Now, two or three of them have now been released, and they've been released based upon the work of lawyers. I think it would be better if those people would make their own defense as a pro se litigant, but then that's my opinion. In most cases, those people haven't got a snowball's chance in hell because they can't represent themselves. And most of you listening to me right now are in the same boat. You can't represent yourself because you haven't got one modicum of trial experience or of legal understanding or knowledge by which you could help yourself. That's just the way reality works. Now, in some cases, you might be able to correct that. That's why we operate a law school, is to help ordinary citizens remedy that problem. But when Dershowitz says, because tyrants, that is, your government, hates lawyers, especially lawyers on the other side, defense lawyers, and works so hard against them, is because they're in fact actually out here helping the citizen, that at least that 15%, that are actually innocent. You know, you can just about bet that 15%, statistically, 15% of the prisoners in Guantanamo are innocent. 15% of the people locked up in our prisons and jails today in America are in fact innocent. They've been wrongly convicted. Did you know that? That's a statistical fact. Now, it is true, the police do get their man. They get the right man 85% of the time. And that's good. But it's that 15% that they're in error on that we need to work on and see if we can't solve that. I mean, if I'm guilty and I've done it, you know, I deserve to go to jail. But if I didn't do it and I'm innocent, then you ought not to lock me up. Now, it isn't surprising, therefore, that the American judicial and prosecutorial establishments are now going after lawyers, especially criminal defense lawyers with a vengeance. And they're currently trying to put outspoken criminal lawyers in jail for responding to prosecutorial press leaks. Now, the leading case involves Bruce Cutler, the New York criminal lawyer who infuriated the legal establishment by securing several acquittals for his client, John Gotti. When Gotti was brought to trial again, prosecutors employed two weapons against his successful defender. Now, first they got Cutler disqualified from representing Gotti. Now they're prosecuting Cutler for criminal contempt on the basis of remarks that he made before he was disqualified. The remarks at issue seem entirely within the orbit of protected speech under the First Amendment, and they include such rhetorical flourishes as accusing the government of throwing the Constitution out the window in its continuing vendetta against Gotti. As if to prove Cutler was right, the trial judge charged Cutler with criminal contempt, and now he faces imprisonment. And as usual, the real villain is the Rehnquist Supreme Court, which in 1991 gave prosecutors and judges the green light to go after nosy defense lawyers. Now, the decision did not, of course, distinguish between prosecuting attorneys and defense lawyers. It gave the courts the power to punish both equally. but such false equality is reminiscent of Anatoly France's ironic quip about the law's majestic equality, and the courts rarely go after prosecutors who leak information to the press. So when the prosecutor leaks information to the press to bias public opinion, that's okay, but when a defense lawyer does it to counter that prosecutor's attack, that's criminal contempt. Now, boys and girls, we're seeing that right now in the case of the Illinois governor, who is, as I speak now, is alleged to have tried to sell the vacant seat of the president-elect Barack Obama's Senate seat to somebody for money. And, of course, to do that would be bribery, and that's against the law. And he ought to be punished for that. But listen, as I speak, there isn't one person, well, I take it back, there is one guy, he hired an attorney, there's one person who's on the governor's side, and that's his lawyer, which is precisely what Dershowitz is arguing here, is that this guy hasn't been convicted yet. The governor of Illinois has not been convicted of what he's alleged to have done, and he may well have done that. But don't you think we ought to give him a trial first? Don't you think we should give him an opportunity to present witnesses in his defense? Don't you think that maybe we ought to give him an opportunity at jury selection first? Shouldn't we give this governor an opportunity to cross-examine his accusers and the witnesses brought against him? Don't you think that he ought to have due process and equal protection of the law? I know it's kind of a wild new concept here in America, but, you know, those are the values that are espoused in our Constitution. Did you know that? And I don't know if the guy's guilty or not. I'm opposed to him because he's a damn Democrat. I mean, I could just come up with 55 reasons why I think we ought to take this Baglevich over here and crucify him. Crucify him! But hey, hang on a second. If we can do that to him, if we can prosecute him in the press, and we can convict him and impeach him from power, you know, impeach him from his office before we have even given him an opportunity to face, confront, cross-examine his accusers. Did it ever occur to you that maybe he's innocent and maybe these charges are false? I mean, has that crossed anybody's mind yet? Could this Baglevich be that one of the 15% that has been charged in error? You know, things like that happen. And so I'm all in favor of giving this guy his day in court. Now, I've listened to the government. I haven't heard anything from Baglevich. And this is the argument that's being made here. That if Baglevich's attorney comes in here and goes to the press and says, hey, let me tell you the other side of the story over here, he does two things. He gives the government an opportunity to go back and prepare against those defenses. And he runs the risk of criminal contempt. God knows what the government or what the judges are going to do to his defense attorney. So what we're going to do is we're going to shut the defense up. We have an agenda. We want this guy out of office. Maybe, in fact, he's guilty of a number of other crimes, and they can't get him for any of those crimes, so they're going to trump one up on him selling this Senate seat. Did that ever occur to you? That's what they did to Milken, you know. The guy pled guilty to some technical violations, and then they said, well, see, he's an insider trader, which the judge had already determined, no, he's not guilty of that. It's like saying, well, you're guilty of rape because you had in mind to go out and commit fornication. Well, now, fornication's also a crime, but it's a lesser crime than rape. Now, what makes this asymmetry worse is that prosecutors are the primary cause of the problem. Defense lawyers speak to the media almost always in an attempt to level the playing field that has been unleveled against their clients by deliberate prosecutorial leaks to the press. And the Gotti case is an example in point. For years, the government's lawyers have been prosecuting John Gotti in the press. Bruce Cutler had an obligation to defend his client in whichever forum the prosecutors selected for their trial. If Gotti was prosecuted only in a court of law, then that's where he should be defended. But if Gotti is being prosecuted in the court of public opinion, then he should be defended there as well. In picking Bruce Cutler for its test case, the government has chosen wisely, even if they haven't chosen fairly. Because Cutler is crude, Cutler is boisterous, and he's a bit too close to his clients for the taste of many in the legal establishment. His detractors outnumber his defenders, and though some establishment groups are worried about the free speech implications of an adverse judgment against Cutler, they are right to be worried. Any ruling against Cutler, no matter how narrow, would stifle the free speech of all defense attorneys around the nation. Bruce Cutler will weather this storm because he's a survivor. The real question is whether or not the First Amendment will survive. Now, that was written in August of 1993. Bruce Cutler was tried for contempt before Judge Thomas C. Platt, the Chief Judge of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York. Chief Judge Platt found Cutler guilty of criminal contempt for violating the gag order imposed by Judge Leo Glasser in the John Gotti case. See United States v. Cutler, 840, Federal Supplement 959. Cutler's appeal of that conviction is pending. I don't know what the outcome of the appeal was. That's not the point of the article. The point of the article is that government, prosecuting attorneys, and judges are out to get defense attorneys. Now, my experience tells me that prosecuting attorneys are a criminal bunch. They do a lot of good work when they convict 85% of the criminal defendants who are in fact guilty. They're a criminal bunch when they convict the 15% who are innocent. And so let's not forget that. And making war against the defense attorneys over here. In some cases, defense attorneys do bad things and they need to be exposed for those wrongs, and those wrongs need to be corrected. But they don't need to be corrected by censorship. They don't need to be corrected by lies and false information. It gives us a distorted view of the truth and of what's really happening. Now again, let me remind you that this book is called The Abuse Excuse. I haven't read another book like it. And except for the Bible, I think that it hits the nail right on the head. In the case of King David, David was the kind of guy that could accept the punishment, could accept the responsibility. He said, yeah, I committed adultery and killed that guy's wife. Yeah, I conducted that census and I'm guilty as hell. Most people are like Adam and Eve. Hey, it's not my fault. It was that woman you gave me. It was her. Hey, it's not me. It was that snake. That serpent over there. That's the guy that deceived me. Hey, it's time that we all woke up, smelled the coffee, and accepted the responsibility that goes with and is opposed to the abuse excuse written by Alan M. Dershowitz. Name of the book, The Abuse Excuse, Alan Dershowitz. Yeah, I'm out of time again here, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.